Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-decision episode of SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Spencer Caron. On December 10, 2020, the Supreme Court decided United States v. Briggs. The question before the court was whether the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces erred in concluding, contrary to its own long-standing precedent, that the Uniform Code of Military Justice allows prosecution of a rape that occurred between 1986 and 2006 only if it was discovered and charged within 5 years. Mr. Briggs argued on appeal that rape was not punishable by death, and thus was subject to the 5-year statute of limitations for non-capital crimes. The United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals rejected his challenge, but upon appeal to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, the CAAF reversed the lower court. Justice Alito wrote for the 8-0 majority, finding that there was no statute of limitations for military rape. Justice Amy Coney Barrett took no part in the decision. Arthur Reiser, Director for Criminal Justice and Civil Liberties and resident senior fellow at the R Street Institute, along with Professor Richard Sala, Assistant Professor of Law at the Vermont Law School, join us today to discuss this decision and its implications.
I'm just going to get us started by just recapping United States versus Briggs. So United States versus Briggs is consolidated with United States versus Collins and United States versus Humphrey Daniels. And in each of these cases, a military member, in this case from the United States Air Force, is accused, tried, and convicted of rape at general court-martial. Each of the trials takes place well after the rape occurred, ranging between 8 years and 17 years after the rape occurred. And really, to understand how we get to United States versus Briggs, we have to take a brief look back to a 2018 case, United States versus Mangahas. Mangahas was a 2015 prosecution of a rape that was committed in 1997, and it was appealed to the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. It was appealed to CAF, and in that case, CAF decides that Coker v. Georgia is applicable in the military context. And this becomes significant because Congress had devised a framework in the Uniform Code where all crimes punishable by death could be prosecuted at any time. And all other crimes, with some exceptions, are going to be subject to a 5-year statute of limitations. After Mangahas, even though the Uniform Code of Military Justice says rape's punishable by death, it's essentially discounted under the theory that because you can't, as a result of Coker v. Georgia, employ the death penalty as a punishment for rape, the time bar reverts to that 5-year statute of limitations. And so let me very briefly kind of work through the Uniform Code. So Article 18 of the Uniform Code gives general court the general court's martial jurisdiction over individuals that are subject to the code for Uniform Code of Military Justice offenses, which include crimes punishable by death when it's specifically authorized by the code. Article 43 sets out the statute of limitations, and as I said earlier, the statute of limitation offenses punishable by death can be tried and punished at any time, and then everything else is essentially subject to that 5-year statute of limitations. Finally, we look to the punitive article, which is Article 120. It's the rape offense, which states specifically states that it shall be punished by death or such other punishment as the court-martial may direct. And so, again, the upshot of the Court of Appeal for the Armed Forces decision in Mangahas is that the rape prosecution is now subject to the 5-year statute of limitations. At the time that Mangahas is decided, United States versus Collins is before the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. That court applies Mangahas, and Collins's prosecution is time barred. The Air Force Judge Advocate General certifies the issue for appellate review, but while they're awaiting the appeal to CAF, CAF confirms Mangahas in a case called United States versus Briggs and confirms the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals in Collins. Subsequently, the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals reverses the conviction of Humphrey Daniels because, again, the prosecution is time barred and the government appeals to the Supreme Court of the United States to basically answer the following question, which we addressed in the last podcast, which is whether the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces erred in concluding, contrary to its own longstanding precedent, that the UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, allows prosecution of a rape that occurred between 1986 and 2006 only if it was discovered and charged within 5 years. And so moving on to the release of the opinion to kind of sum up the arguments that were advanced and addressed by the court, and there were some that weren't, which Arthur will touch on later. But to sum up the arguments advanced and addressed by the court, respondents contended that the phrase punishable by death in Article 43 means capable of punishment by death when all applicable law is taken into account, right, including the Eighth Amendment. Whereas the government sees the phrase punishable by death as meaning capable of punishment by death under the penalty provisions of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And so Justice Alito delivers the opinion of the unanimous court in favor of the government and basically setting out three reasons for favoring the government's interpretation. And he starts by noting that dictionary definitions of punishable lend some validity to the respondent's arguments. But he goes on to say that definitions here aren't going to answer the question, the question of punishable under what law, right? So the court then goes on to provide some context beyond those definitions, those dictionary definitions, and then goes on to say that these three reasons weigh heavily in favor of the government. And so the first point that the court lays out in its opinion is that a natural referent or statute of limitations provision within the Uniform Code of Military Justice is the Uniform Code of Military Justice itself. And so as an example, the court notes that no one would read Article 43's reference to offenses to include those under state law. It's a reference to offenses in the Uniform Code. The court also notes that many crimes included the punishable by death language in the Uniform Code. And Justice Alito says, presumably to save from including the long list of offenses punishable by death in Article 43, Congress just said, if it's punishable by death in the punitive articles, there's not going to be a time bar. Everything else is 5 years. And the court specifically notes this is going to be true if provisions elsewhere in the code might provide a defense against the imposition of the death penalty. So that's the first prong of Justice Alito's opinion, and I'll hand it off to Arthur for that second prong.
Yeah, thank you. I just tap in a little bit on what Richard said. One of the things that I thought was really interesting is they really drill down on the word uniform, and that's something that Richard pointed out. And it's called the UCMJ for a reason, and they intended it specifically as an inclusive overhaul of how justice was to be administered in the armed forces. So it was interesting that they really focused on the word uniform to make their case, and rightly so. Another area that another point that Alito wrote was specifically about the goals of the statute limitations, and he wrote that one of the goals of the statute limitations is clarity. In fact, it could be the paramount goal that all others kind of rest upon. And when Congress wrote the UCMJ, they would have undermined the goal of clarity by basing its application on future Supreme Court jurisprudence. So think about that. It's an unusual stance from the Supreme Court to basically clip their own wings. And I'll say it again, when Congress wrote the UCMJ, they would have undermined the goal of clarity as it relates to the statute of limitation by basing its applicability on future Supreme Court jurisprudence. So therefore, it is unlikely that Congress would have forsaken the goal of clarity by intending it to be open for forces of extra UCMJ jurisprudence. So the first two points almost wrap around on each other, exactly what Professor Soliver was just talking about. We know when Article 43A, which states there is no statute of limitations for these particular crimes, was written, the UCMJ is uniform, and it is unlikely that Congress would have forsaken its own goals as it relates to statutes of limitations by leaving extra UCMJ jurisprudence to be decided and formed later. And if you look at, and if you watch, and I highly recommend that you do, the same presentation that Richard and I did a few months ago on the oral arguments, you can almost see this coming. You can see the questions they were asking to specifically kind of foreshadow what their decision was going to be. Okay, another point that I think is important is the underpinnings of the statute of limitations and those of cruel and unusual punishment clause do not overlap. And that was another, and probably the third point that Alito made. You know, when statutes of limitations concern the difficulty of putting together a case and presenting a prosecution, the cruel and unusual punishment clause concerns, you know, really depending on who you ask. But this is what Alito, I believe, was saying, was either, you know, the evolving standard of decency or original intent. And so if you run those kind of overarching ideals through this case, the court basically says that, or Alito, you know, specifically says that it is the government wins. So the last thing that I'm going to talk about before turning it back over, so we can talk about, you know, what Gorsuch added to this. But one of the arguments that the majority did not resolve, which I thought was particularly interesting, because it almost seems like they're adding a hole to be addressed later on. But the CAF previously held that Article 55, that's the UCMJ's own prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. Remember, the UCMJ basically takes everything that we think about and civilian life constitutional standards and then codifies it. So, you know, the Miranda rights are codified within the UCMJ. And so, in essence, Brady is codified within the UCMJ. So Article 55 is the UCMJ's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment was to be afforded as much protection as the Eighth Amendment. So that is a previous decision by CAF. That's U.S. versus, is it Wappler? Is that the right, Richard? I think it is. It's W-A-P-P-L-E-R. And the majority dismissed this by basically stating that article, direct permission of the death penalty for rape is to be the most natural place to look for Congress's answer to whether or not rape was punishable by death within the meaning of Article 43A in the first place. So therefore, the court says that they don't need to decide whether or not Eighth Amendment applies through Article 55 of the UCMJ. So there is some room for more things to be cited later on. But, you know, with an 8-0 decision, in essence, in favor of the government, well, depending on how you count, 7-1, depending on where you want to put Gorsuch on that, which Professor Stiles is going to talk about, this was a really clear decision and really clear jurisprudence that I think will give clear guidance to the military. And that's something else that we talked about in the last teleforum. You know, one of the themes that you're going to see always when it relates to UCMJ is ensuring there's bright line rules, because ultimately the military's goal is not to decide what is right or wrong here in the comfort of U.S. courtrooms, but it's decide what is right or wrong and during the horrors of war. And so we need to have very clear rules and guidance about what we're telling our young men and women who put on the uniform. So I think, you know, what we're going to talk about now is how Gorsuch added his fingerprints to this, and then a few other notes that Professor Sal and I are going to add to the end.
Thanks a lot, Arthur. Appreciate it. So we'll just take one brief moment to address the very, very short one paragraph dissent laid out by Justice Gorsuch, who, again, as Arthur noted, it is an 8-0 opinion because Justice Gorsuch agrees with the court's decision on the merits, and Justice Barrett doesn't participate in the opinion. Justice Gorsuch does give us one paragraph essentially saying that he continues to believe that the court lacks jurisdiction to hear appeals directly from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. I mean, this is at least a little bit interesting because while Justice Alito writes the opinion in this case, he also wrote the dissent in a case in 2018, Ortiz versus the United States, where Justice Alito in that dissent basically says, you know, these are executive branch officers. These are they are not wielding, you know, Article III power. And so they can't exercise the federal government's judicial power. And that fact basically would compel the court to dismiss, in that case, Ortiz's petition for lack of jurisdiction. And Justice Gorsuch just gives us an opinion, a paragraph to reiterate the dissent in Ortiz, which Justice Gorsuch also joined, saying there's an issue with jurisdiction here. But at least six other members of the court here believe there is jurisdiction. And again, Justice Gorsuch joins the opinion, the court's decision on the merits. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Arthur.
Yeah, so kind of some closing thoughts and comments. You know, if you guys listened to the last teleforum, we were right. I am vindicated. We both predicted a decision in favor of the government. I predicted a 6-2 in favor based on specifically on statutory grounds. And I think that prediction pretty much came to fruition with the court only addressing this on statutory grounds and punting on the Eighth Amendment problem, which is, I think, exactly what we predicted. I mean, the main difference is that the 6-2 prediction turned into an 8-0. And so, you know, I think some of my closing thoughts on this are, I think this decision really leads credence to the quote from Justice Kagan some years ago that we are all textualists now. And I see this as not only something, a theme that we're going to see, obviously we just saw in this case, I think it's something you're going to see kind of in the Supreme Court for years to come. You know, less, you know, decisions based on emotion, what's happening right now, and more based on what is the text. I would be surprised if we saw the court address whether or not the Eighth Amendment applies directly to the UCMJ in the next few years. They can always sidestep big decisions on statutory grounds. But if this or some other case like it works its way up to the court again, they don't have much room to run away from that issue. So I predict that if they don't want to address that, they're just not going to pick it up. That is my prediction over the next, you know, 5 or 6 years. Richard, do you have any kind of parting thoughts for our listeners who have so graciously given us their time?
Very briefly, I'll just say I was also glad to see that we got it right. It came out in favor of the government, although I will admit that I did think there was a chance that we would see more discussion of the Eighth Amendment issue, if not in the opinion in a concurrence, but we didn't see that. Nevertheless, interesting case, and like Arthur, I think the opportunities to address the Eighth Amendment issue in the military context are going to be few and far between, so I would expect this to carry us along for quite some time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.